Hello and welcome to a Weekly Stuff bonus podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here for the fourth month in a row to do a monthly classic Doctor Who rewatch. We have been going through every month and picking one story from each Doctor of the classic Doctor Who era.
Yeah.
Sean, what have we done so far?
Let's see, for the first Doctor we did the historical story, the Aztecs. For the second Doctor we did, of course, the classic, The Tomb of the Cybermen. And the Cybermen, and for the third Doctor, we did the action epic, The Demons.
Yes, so we have had a great lineup so far. If you've been following along, that's awesome. If you're new to this, the whole point of the project is, if you have never seen Classic Who before, we're trying to ease you in with good picks for each era of the show. And if you are a longtime Classic Doctor Who fan, we're revisiting favorite memories.
Yep.
Sean has seen every episode of Classic Doctor Who. I've seen a lot more recently, because I'm three-fifths of the way through my third Doctor rewatch, but I had to jump ahead a little bit today, because Sean, what are we watching and talking about tonight?
Yes, so for this episode, you know, as I said, we've done the first three Doctors, and now we're jumping ahead to Tom Baker, the fourth Doctor, who is obviously the most well-known, the longest-running ever Doctor with seven seasons of the show, and we're doing his second season story, The Brain of Morbius, which is delightful.
Oh, Sean, is it delightful?
Yes. So as you said, as people probably know listening to this, I've already seen all these episodes before. I've seen The Brain of Morbius. This is maybe the third or fourth time I've seen it, because it's a personal favorite of mine, on top of being, I think, a really good representative episode for this era of the show. But this was your first time watching it, Jonathan, so I want your just like general impressions.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Like, obviously we're picking kind of the best of the best every time.
Uh-huh.
I'm curious if you're just going to throw in a really awful one at some point for one of these.
I could if I wanted
to. It's just for fun. But yeah, I'm going to do Time and the Ronnie for the seventh Doctor. No, not really. But no, at least this first time through, we're picking good ones.
Yeah.
But no, even then, knowing that, man, these have all been really good, I was kind of taken aback just how good Brain of Morbius is. Not that it's, like, better than necessarily some of the other ones we've looked at. These are all top-tier Doctor Who stories. But what struck me about The Brain of Morbius is that it is a story type and a tone and atmosphere type that other eras of Classic Who and all of modern Doctor Who don't even touch, don't even attempt. Like, you can't even say that there are episodes kind of like this. Like, there are horror-themed episodes, but not, like, hardcore gothic horror, universal monster movie horror in the way Brains of Morbius is. And so, I was watching this one, I just had the biggest smile on my face. It is four parts, and it feels like it could, if you told me it was just a 45-minute modern Doctor Who episode, I'd believe you, because it just flies by.
Yeah.
It is so packed with cool stuff. The performances are great. But I especially love that we get to talk about it, because I think this is what makes rewatching classic Doctor Who so fun for this project, is that you get to see things like this that you would never see today on the show. And that's not to put down the modern era of the show, just that Doctor Who, as is its wont, always changes and transforms, and this is an era that has not really been replicated, and I loved watching this.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about like the idea of this era of Doctor Who, because you know that's sort of one of the lenses we've been looking at it as, is, you know, it's not just like, oh, it's a different actor playing the Doctor, but there's a lot of changes that happen behind the scenes that inform the sort of the tone and arcs of the show. Because this is, looking at this, we are at season 13 of classic Doctor Who. So this show had been going on for a long time already at this point. It had been gone through, if you've been listening to our other episodes, a number of different changes. And so last episode we talked about The Demons and the Third Doctor era. In particular, we talked about how that era introduced these sorts of like big figures behind the production that were really stable and had a lot of influence. In particular for the Third Doctor, it's the producer Barry Letts, who is effectively was the showrunner at the time. And then there's also script editor Terrence Dix, who's important to talk about for this episode as well. And so that sort of like producer script editor role is kind of like what we, when we talk about Russell T. Davis or Stephen Moffat as the showrunner of Doctor Who in modern Doctor Who. That's sort of the equivalent back then. And so Barry Letts left kind of with John Pertwee, and it was a full reset, basically. I think there were a number of the scripts from Tom Baker's first season were left over from Barry Letts' picks. But generally speaking, we were moving on to a whole new era of the show, not just in terms of who's playing the Doctor, but in terms of the people making the show. And the two really significant figures to look at for this sort of the first 3 to 4 years of the Fourth Doctor's era is producer Philip Hinchcliffe and then script editor Robert Holmes, who is also effectively the writer of this episode. The writing of, like, who wrote The Brain of Morbius is a bigger discussion that we'll get into. But first I want to talk about Philip Hinchcliffe, who is one of the more sort of well-known and famous behind-the-scenes figures of Doctor Who, because he was like the guy behind the scenes and the guy behind the curtain for these 3 years from 1974 to 1977 of Doctor Who that are widely considered by fans and myself as being one of the most sort of like qualitatively remarkable periods in the history of the show, that also has this really great sense of tone and atmosphere and style that's fairly consistent. And The Brain of Morbius, I think, is the most just like tonally rich of these episodes that has this gothic horror vibe to it that we were talking about. That Philip Hinchcliffe very much had this vision for what he wanted Doctor Who to be, that it moved away from the very earthbound stories of the Third Doctor, and you're in space basically all the time, constantly. There's like one story in his run, other than Robot, which is the Fourth Doctor's first story, that is like basically just the Third Doctor story with Tom Baker in it. With the exception of that, there's only one other story, the Android Invasion, in Hinchcliffe's era that is set on Earth at all. And so everything is like, you're out in space, it's all aliens, it's all craziness, and then also he injected a lot of that sort of gothic horror tone that is borrowed from both like the classic Universal horror monster movies. You can feel a lot of DNA there, and then also the Hammer horror movies that are kind of concurrent with when these episodes were going out in the mid to late 70s. And so he had a huge amount of influence in the direction of the show in kind of cementing this idea of, okay, we're going to do these kinds of, in some ways, a lot of them are kind of takes on classic horror tropes and ideas, like Brain of Morbius is very obviously heavily inspired by Frankenstein, particularly the James Whale movie. Yeah, so.
Yeah.
Hinchcliffe, really, and he's also just a really smart guy. If you ever see any interviews with him, I recommend looking some of it, because he's done a bunch of bonus features, obviously, for Doctor Who DVDs over the years. So you can look up those on YouTube, or if you have the DVDs for these. He knows what the fuck he's talking about when he talks about this show.
It is one of the fun parts for me of I'm working through the Third Doctor run on my own time, and I'll get to the Fourth Doctor stuff, and this made me really eager to get there.
Uh-huh.
Because I've got some good stuff coming up with the Third Doctor, but I've also kind of moved through maybe his most famous seasons.
Yeah.
And so, like, I've only got one more Master story left, which is kind of sad. But anyway, I'm really excited to get there, and it's also fun when I, you know, you just skip ahead. Like, I'm, you know, currently, like, again, I'm on season 10, which is, like, the 10th anniversary season. You got the Three Doctors, things like that. But it's, you know, firmly Third Doctor era, Joe Grant's last year, and then I had to skip ahead to this season 13, and the Fourth Doctor clearly has so firmly established himself. Yeah. And his tone, it's like, right, a lot of stuff is about to change in this show, and I love it. I love that, you know, like, just a couple years across, Doctor Who could just decide, you know what, we're going to do a haunted house story in space.
Yeah.
And just, it's going to be a universe, and you won't even really remember that, right, they're on an alien planet, and that's important. It just feels like a great Universal monster movie.
Yeah. And it's something that, it's like when you skip that drastically from, like, the mid-Third Doctor period, where there's, like, maybe one or two space set stories in a season, to, like, the middle of, like, I mean, not the middle, like relatively early on, but in terms of the Hinchcliffe era, the middle of the Hinchcliffe era of the Fourth Doctor. And it's like, if you didn't see the TARDIS, and you didn't, and they didn't say the words Doctor, and you didn't, like, know that that's, like, it's the same show, you'd think it's a totally different fucking program. Like, it's almost unrecognizable in so many ways.
Yeah.
Just, like, stylistically speaking. So that's Philip Hinchcliffe as the producer. But then the other guy we have to talk about with this episode is a man near and dear to my heart. It's the great Robert Holmes, who is still, in my opinion, the best single writer in the history of Doctor Who. He had written a number of stories previously, and actually I have all of his scripts up here. So before this, he wrote, there are two Second Doctor era stories, one of which, The Space Pirates, does not exist, but the other one, The Crotons, that's one of the best Second Doctor ones. But then in the Third Doctor era, Robert Holmes was very prolific in the Third Doctor era as well. He wrote Spearhead from Space, which is John Pertwee's first story, also is like the introduction of the Autons. He wrote Terror of the Autons, which is the introduction of the Master. So Robert Holmes also wrote the first script that had the Master in it. Then Carnival of Monsters, which you have not gotten to, right, Jonathan?
My next one.
Yeah, so that one's really good. That's coming up for you. And then The Time Warrior, which we have talked about.
I love The Time Warrior.
Yes, a much older version of this podcast, where that was, at the time, and might still be my favorite Third Doctor story. So that's fantastic. And then before Brain of Morbius, he wrote The Ark in Space, which is the first Fourth Doctor story where he goes out into space. That's an amazing story. And then he also wrote Pyramids of Mars, which was the other one I was considering for doing for this episode. It was a kind of a toss-up between that and Brain of Morbius.
Like, in a modern context, Robert Holmes in the Third Doctor era is kind of like Stephen Moffat in the Russell T. Davies era.
Yeah.
In that he'd come in, like, every year and contribute, like, the best script of the year and blow everything. And even when the rest of the show is great, it would just... And then he kind of helped, you know, co-run the show at this point, and his fingerprints are all over it. Because Robert Holmes, you know, I have not seen all of his episodes, but I've also seen some of his future stories past this point.
Yeah.
Like Caves of Androzani and stuff. Yeah. Which he came back to do that after 6 years off Doctor Who, which is just an amazing thing in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
He just has such a unique voice and outlook. And I think he and Philip Hinchcliffe are so good together because they clearly are both stealth weirdos. And they're into just dark, fucked up stuff.
Yeah, and so it is something where Robert Holmes, during this period, for these 3 years, he is the script editor on the show. So I think it's one of the reasons why this era of the show is so great, just like across the board. It's very rare that there are no bad stories, and there are only a handful that are just kind of like average okay stories. But the general quality is so high, I think, because Robert Holmes has such an incredible understanding of how to write Doctor Who, in particular how to write... I think for me what stands out is like all the supporting characters in an episode. Because obviously he's great at writing the Doctor and the Companion, but lots and lots and lots of writers of Doctor Who are good at writing the Doctor and the Companion.
You have to be. It's kind of one of the prerequisites.
If you can't write the Doctor and the Companion well, then it's like that's just a horrible fucking episode. But what separates a like good episode of Doctor Who from like an all-time classic is that ability to make the supporting characters and like the one-off villain and the one-off like sidekick character or whatever that's in the episode, making all of them really memorable and fleshed out and interesting and compelling. And that's something that's true about, I think, every single Robert Holmes story, is he's always able to do that. And I think he's able to inject that in the scripts that even he didn't sort of directly write.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to say what is Robert Holmes' most famous story. Yeah. I think a lot of people might jump to Caves of Androzani just because that's... Especially because of when it aired and, like, there's not as much famous around it, you know?
Yeah.
But that's like the defining thing about that story is if you ask people what makes that great, it's, oh, the Doctor's really interesting, it's the one episode Perry isn't annoying, and oh my god, that Shallon Jacks guy or whatever his name is.
Yeah, the villain.
Yeah, the villain is amazing. But like, I was noticing this with Brain of Morbius here, is that if Doctor Who in the classic era, you either have serials that are like perfect for the amount of time they air in, and they are really compact and dense in their storytelling. Or you have ones, I actually just watched a good example of this called The Time Monster, not The Time Warrior.
Right.
It's the Third Doctor's, it's the season 9 finale, the last serial there, and it's a master story. I think it's a ton of fun, like it's a really goofy kind of off. They were clearly trying to one-up the Daemons, it's the same, it's Barry Letson, it's the Robert Sloman, that pseudonym. But that's a six-parter that just is off the walls with so many things going on, so many characters, so many weird ideas. And then you look at like a Robert Holmes script like this one, The Brain of Morbius, there's actually not that many characters in it. Like the principals, it's the Doctor, Sarah Jane, the villain, what's his name?
Solon.
Solon. Yeah. You have the Igor guy.
Yeah, Kondo.
Kondo. And you have the leader of the Sisterhood of Karn, and that's your five leads. And that's it for all four episodes. And you have, you know, the other sisters and stuff, but they're not like major characters. And it feels like a busy four episodes because so much conflict happens within that small set of characters. But you realize, right, it's less is more. It's five super interesting characters with everyone like interacts in different permutations over the course of those four episodes. And so it feels like kind of a fuller, bigger, denser episode or story of Doctor Who than one of those kind of busy off-the-walls ones you'll get once in a while. And I think I just think of any Robert Holmes story off the top of my head. You know, Spirit from Space is another great one for this because that kind of introduced us to the Third Doctor era, and that's all about how you define the people around the Doctor.
Yeah.
And he was the right guy to set the tone for that. So I think it's an important thing to consider here.
Because that's the other thing to sort of like talk about with Robert Holmes' is history on the show is that like the Stephen Moffat comparison is pretty good in some ways for like the Stephen Moffat RTD era thing of like, oh, you come in one season, you write like the defining story of that season. But he also had this like insane track record of writing things that then were like really important in the history of Doctor Who. So it's like Spearhead from Space is the model, is like the template for how to do a like Doctor-generated story and the first story for a new Doctor. Like basically every single story after that was a Doctor's first story is either like directly modeled after Spearhead from Space, or is like intentionally modeled against Spearhead from Space, right?
And the twin dilemma.
Yeah, exactly. And so then you have, you know, he wrote the first script with the Master, and so he basically sort of like set the template for who the Master was as a character. He also then wrote one of my personal favorites is The Deadly Assassin, which is a really interesting story for a couple of reasons. Is that it's the one of the only stories in the history of Doctor Who where the Doctor is without companion. And it's the story where the Doctor goes to Gallifrey, like, he's basically been called to Gallifrey, and he says, bye, Sarah Jane, you can't come with me, and goes off to Gallifrey. And that establishes stuff, like, basically, he set the tone and trend for how the Gallifreyan society and the Time Lords were depicted then forward, because you had some depictions of them, like, in the ten or the three Doctors beforehand, but not a lot. And that kind of, like, really set the tone for, like, when we go to Gallifrey, this is what they're like, and like the, you know, they have the Matrix and they have all this kind of stuff there. And then he set the, like, he created the like 12 regeneration cycle. That was a Robert Holmes thing. Like, a lot of those big pieces of Doctor Who history he also had his hand in. So,
oh, and just yeah. Look at how much modern Doctor Who writers steal from Robert Holmes all yeah. over the place. And steal in the best way possible, right? But like, you know, Russell T. Davies brings back Doctor Who. What's he do in his first episode? Let's bring the Autons in.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know, Stephen Moffat wants to do something weird and classic-y with the Eighth Doctor for that 50th anniversary mini-movie. Who does he bring in? Sisterhood of Karn from yeah. here. And then he uses them over and over in the 12th Doctor era. Just like, sometimes it's little things like Sisterhood of Karn. I shouldn't say little, but like more obscure, because they're yeah. not like a recurring Doctor Who villain. Or it's, you know, a little more obvious like the Autons. Just down to, I think, how the Doctor sometimes talks and interacts with people. Just clearly, like, I don't think you can write Doctor Who without having internalized Robert Holmes.
Yeah.
And so when you say, like, he's the best Doctor Who writer, it's almost like that's not even an opinion. It's just like, I don't yeah. know if there can be another one.
Yeah, it would be like, I think Stephen Moffat is the closest you can get. Like, and he's like, Stephen Moffat is very much like that for the new series in a lot of ways. But yeah, like,
Robert But we also don't know what Doctor Who looks like in 30 years and, exactly. and what do they take from Stephen Moffat. Yeah. And those sorts of things.
Yeah, so you know, that's the sort of like what's going on behind the scenes that sort of defines the tone of this era of Doctor Who that brings us into the brain of Morbius, which is just, I want to note, like, I don't think there's a huge amount to talk about with this here, but it's really the fun coincidence that this story is also directed by Christopher Barry, who directed The Demons, who's directed a number of classic Doctor Who stories.
I did want to bring that up, and I wanted to bring up one other contributor to this episode. But on Christopher Barry, I almost even thought it while I was watching, because this episode, like The Demons, makes such good use of space
yeah.
and like setting and atmosphere, and I'm like, I know Christopher Barry went on to do a ton after The Demons. Like, is that... Oh, yeah, that's Christopher Barry at the end. The other person we need to note, because we actually have not mentioned this on the podcast yet, is the composer for this episode.
Yes, yeah.
Was Dudley Simpson, who was one of the most prolific classic Doctor Who composers. Unlike modern Doctor Who, classic Who did not have one composer at a time. They would kind of cycle through on a story-by-story basis. But Dudley Simpson did over 60 stories in classic Doctor Who, which is a huge amount.
Yeah, like through the entire run of the show as right. well. It wasn't just like focusing on the era. Like, if you watch an episode of classic Doctor Who, chances are at some point in the credits it's going to say incidental music by Dudley Simpson.
Yeah.
I don't know how many times I have seen those words in my life at this point.
Yep, and yeah, because 60 stories, but then think of how many episodes that is. Yeah. Because that's like at least four, you know, 60 times four. And Dudley Simpson unfortunately passed away earlier this month on November 4th in Australia. Yeah. He was 95. He was born in 1922. I guess he was Australian. He was born in Australia. Just, you know, the Doctor Who classic music can sometimes be up and down, but not when Dudley Simpson is there.
Yeah.
They're almost always great. Like, I notice it too when I see his name at the end. It's like, yep, that episode had good music. And I actually think I'm glad we almost waited to talk about him and his death until this, and we had the chance to do it, because I think Brain of Morbius has a particularly notable classic Doctor Who score. I think it does a ton for the atmosphere and tone of this episode. It is very, very good.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because it was something I was going to bring up when we talked about when we were going to talk about the episode, but I think it is important to bring it out here, because it is something where the thing that was in many ways most remarkable about Dudley Simpson's music on the show is that, again, he covered stuff from the first Doctor era all the way through. So, like, he spanned the entirety of classic Doctor Who, and And as we're only talking about the first four Doctors so far, and we've already seen the huge breadth of different kinds of stories that classic Doctor Who handled. It's like he had to compose music for all of those different genres and settings and tones and styles. Like, and he made all of them work. And I think this is a particularly notable episode for him because he does incorporate more of like the kinds of music that you would expect from a Universal Horror monster movie. And it has, because he usually kind of would side on more sort of like in the background kind of music and stuff that's a bit more, especially once you get to like the John Nathan Turner era, stuff that's a bit more techno-y and sounds a bit more electronic. But for this, he brings in a lot more sort of like string instruments and stuff that gives this sort of like quiet, subtle, gothic vibe to everything that is, it really helps a lot in setting the tone. So yes, yeah, Dudley Simpson is an important person to talk about whenever you're talking about Doctor Who.
Well, and with the music, and just thinking about that and the overall tone of the episode, I guess if we're transitioning to talking about the story, the first thing I just want to say is that I was watching this, and by the end of the second episode, I was thinking, you could just cut this together, strip out all the Doctor Who references, and just say this is like an amazing like Hammer horror movie from the 70s that Britain released, and I wouldn't bat an eye at it. I'd be like, the video quality's a little low because it was shot on beta tape.
Yeah.
Other than that, like, this is just a great horror movie.
Yeah, it's just, for me, the thing to talk about with The Brain of Morbius is, like, the most exceptional quality of it, I think, is, like, tone and atmosphere. It so has just this, like, really rich, like, just foggy atmosphere to it that is established immediately where the TARDIS materializes on the planet of Karn. We don't know it's Karn yet, but that's where we are. And the Doctor gets out of the TARDIS and starts yelling up at the sky because the Time Lords have interfered again. The Time Lords have pulled him out and plopped him on some planet. And you know, he and Sarah Jane are sort of, like, exploring the surrounding area, and it's all covered in fog, and it's just this very dark, dreary planet. It starts raining, and there's, like, heavy torrential rain when there can be. But it always feels like it's raining, whether or not they actually could make it rain in some scenes or not, I guess is the point. But then also there's a great shot of Sarah Jane looks over a cliff and sees that this wasteland of a planet, that there are all these crashed ships. And the effects are sort of cheesy because, you know, it's classic Doctor Who, but it still sets the right tone. With also, it has if it was modern Doctor Who, it would be a cold open, but they didn't do cold opens back then, of this weird, like, praying mantis alien having crash landed on the planet and being and dying, and then this Igor-like figure comes and takes his head off. But that all sets this tone of darkness and just, like, dreary gothic dread and this thick, soupy fog and rain that you're in for the whole episode. The whole episode is just dark and downcast in the perfect way.
And I know the effects are cheesy, and I understand why you say that. I love the studio work in this episode. I love the sets. I love the matte paintings. I love that it isn't afraid to lean into the artifice of it and let it feel a bit theatrical in some ways, where some of the sets are constructed, especially when they're outside. It actually reminds me of a lot of early Japanese cinema, where, again, not afraid of the artifice of just, we'll have a backdrop up there and we'll have a couple of little bushes and something.
Yeah,
and
it's
we'll
like very clearly, obviously on a studio. They're not even, like, trying to hide it.
That's okay. That's okay. You can do that. That's one of the reasons why we compare this to Universal Monster movies is they were really good at that.
Yeah.
You know, and they're more expensive sets in those cases because they're big Hollywood budgets. But I love this. It reminded me a lot of some of the shots in the Aztecs, which is the first one we talked about on this mini-series we're doing, and the Aztecs is a black and white one. This one's in color, so it's kind of nice to see how the team has kind of evolved over the years. But where you have those, like, matte paintings and your interesting, like, architecture that they've put together. And I think they're just really good at bringing you into a specific time and place. The Aztecs was something historical. This is something, you know, more genre-oriented.
Yeah.
But it's still, like, I think they do a really good job with, you know, the limited resources to show a lot of imagination in the set design. And I think especially the interiors of this episode, like all of the Doctor's lab, not the Doctor.
Yeah, Solon.
Solon's lab. It's just amazing. I love the use of color in this one, too.
Yeah, it's particularly, I think they make really good use of their sets for Solon's lab. And there's a good sense of space in there because there's like three or four different rooms that kind of go to where it's like the big main hall which is a great set with, like, you know, the bust of Morbius and this nice table in the middle. And then you have, like, the secret underground room where Morbius's brain is in. And then you have, like, the Solon sort of operating room that's off to the side. And you revisit all those locations multiple times over the four episodes. And then the other sort of location. And then there's, like, I guess there's a sort of, like, intervening space that where they're just kind of on the planet. And but then the other main area that they're in is the sort of the cavern that the Sisterhood of Karn lives in, where the flame of eternal life is there, and the elixir, and all this sorts and all that sort of mystical stuff.
It's one of the one of the things I want to talk about is that this episode does, in some ways, feel like two episode ideas mashed together, but it is mashed so gracefully. Yeah. Where you have this one threat that is the Sisterhood of Karn, who have this long-standing relationship with the Time Lords, but it has soured over the years. It was always uneasy. They're worried their sacred flame is going out. The Doctor arrives at just the wrong moment for that, as he often does. And then at the same time, you have on the other side of the planet, or not, but, you know, other area on the planet, you have Solon, who's doing these experiments with these brains because he has this Master Morbius, all this stuff. And the Doctor, for the first two episodes especially, is just ping-ponged between these two sort of small factions and is trying to figure out how to navigate them. And they're both the antagonists to the Doctor, at least.
Yeah.
And I love that. And I think I can easily imagine that, you know, you could tell one story about either of these things, but it's so much richer for having both of these big ideas clashing. And I love it.
Yeah. And it's the playoff between the two different factions. And I think one of the important things is that both, like the thing that both factions are after are the same thing. They're both after eternal life. Like, Morbius wants it through science and having his brain transplanted into a Frankenstein monster-esque body, and then the Sisterhood have it through the sort of, like, what they sort of, like, feel and portray as being this very mystical thing. But it is, like, the Doctor also says, like, oh, it's, you know, this is science. Like, this is, like, a freak coincidence of, like, gases of the planet interacting with the specific minerals of this of these rocks to create this elixir that somehow grants you immortal life. But it is both of these groups are revolving around the same thematic concept, which is eternal life. And the Doctor, of course, obviously, as he is often put, and I think particularly Tom Baker is very good at this, because we're going to do another Fourth Doctor story for the next episode, which will be City of Death, which puts him in a similar role of being in the middle between two sort of like opposing sides, and him finding this path that's saying, like, no, like, this is, it's like, this is what is valuable about this concept, is like life needs to end at some point. There has to be change. It has to evolve. If you actually have eternal life, you're just going to be stagnant. And I think that sort of thematic hook and crutch that both things swing around is what allows that episode to work, which is something that in my personal rewatch of the Russell T. Davis era, I've been encountering a number of episodes that have a similar thing of, like, oh, there are two big ideas that each of these could be their own episode. But the issue for a lot of those stories, like School Reunion is a good example, like, talk about Sarah Jane. That's the one where Sarah Jane comes back, and it's all about, like, oh, Sarah Jane is back. But then there's also an episode, the story about this, like, school and all this, like, alien invasion of the school. And both of those are ideas that, like, are their own Doctor Who episode, but they have nothing to do with each other. This story finds a way to connect both of these disconnected ideas, and that's what makes it work.
And that's what I mean. Like, it's gracefully put together. Because I can totally, and then we can talk about, like, the history of the writing of this episode. I don't know how it all shook out. But, like, I could imagine that, you know, maybe these ideas were originated separately or something. But the way they are all kind of massaged together in the episode, you're absolutely right. There is this thematic thing. It's the Doctor being ping-ponged between them both, literally, in that his body is being taken and transported and, you know, thrown between these two factions. But also that he is having to try to walk this line between them. And, boy, is this an amazing showcase for the talents of Mr. Tom Baker.
Yeah. Yeah, so before, I think that's a good segue to talk about, like, character stuff and talking about the Doctor. But before that, I want to just sort of address what you brought up there briefly about the writing of the episode, which is, it's basically considered that this story is written by Robert Holmes. Like, that's how everybody sort of thinks of it. But it is, it's credited under the pseudonym Robin Bland, which is a good weird pseudonym that the sort of the history behind it is, the original sort of, like, pitch and script for the story was written by Terrence Dix, a long, long time, like, great Doctor Who writer and contributor of the show since the Second Doctor era and well past this point, and a really good Doctor Who writer. But I think one of the things that happened was the original idea of the story revolved a lot around the idea of, instead of it being more sort of, like, Frankenstein monster-y, it was more about, like, robots and this, like, robotic robot perception of, like, eternal life and that kind of stuff. And there were budgetary reasons for why they couldn't do the robot thing, because that would have been too expensive. So basically, Robert Holmes was in a position as script editor where he had to almost completely rewrite the script, taking some of the core ideas and characters and concepts, but having to change the episode to the extent where Terrence Dix did not want to be credited on it.
And I love the story of why they couldn't get Terrence Dix to do it.
Yeah.
Is he was out of the country at the time and yes. they couldn't reach him. Literally couldn't happen today.
Yeah.
That just wouldn't, unless like Terrence Dix went to like a monastery and like threw his phone away. I just love that this is a scenario where it's like, we don't know where he is. Robert Holmes, you've got to write the episode. I kind of love that.
Yeah. And so like this happened a couple of times on his run. This is also actually how The Ark in Space was written, because that story was originally going to be written by John Lucarati, who is the writer of The Aztecs. So like weird connections there. But Robert Holmes had to sort of step in and write that episode also as script editor. And so, yeah, that's sort of like the weird history of this story, of like how the story was written. For the purposes of this discussion, we're just going to consider it having been written by Robert Holmes.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Because it's too confusing trying to be like, oh, well, is this like a Terrence Dix idea or Robert Holmes one? That's sort of whatever.
It's such a Robert Holmes episode.
You very much can feel it. So that's sort of, yeah, that's that stuff aside. I think the easiest way to talk about this is we have to talk about Tom Baker as the Fourth Doctor, because he is such an insane, bizarre, larger-than-life presence, both in episodes and like in the history of the show. He looms so large, and it's interesting for me, like with you, Jonathan, that you have seen only a handful of Tom Baker's stories.
Yes.
And you haven't seen like a lot of them in a row, right? Like
no.
It's just been sort of like piecemeal here and there. And he's such a strange version of the character. Like, I feel like he's hard. I remember when I was doing my first big watch through, it took me a while to get a sense of like, who the fuck is this guy? So this being, you know, the third or fourth maybe story you've seen with Tom Baker, how do you feel about him? Who is this guy to you?
I love him, but let's preamble that a little bit.
Okay.
Which is, I have definitely seen more of 1, 2, and 3 than I have of 4. Like,
yeah.
I've seen more William Hartnell, Patrick Troughton, and especially now John Pertwee stories than I have Tom Baker. And, you know, one of the other... This might be only the second Tom Baker story I've seen in full. I know I've seen parts of other ones, but I know one of the other ones I've seen in full was The Talons of Wang Chiang.
Yes,
and
also
I remember,
a Robert Holmes story.
Yeah, I remember liking that one a lot, but also being like, I am having trouble getting a read on Tom Baker in the way you don't when you're watching a John Pertwee or a Patrick Troughton. Or today, like if you were to turn on a David Tennant or a Matt Smith, it's like you just kind of get their doctors right off the bat.
Yeah.
Tom Baker is both a larger-than-life, crazy version of the Doctor and a kind of quieter, less imposing one, because he doesn't have as many kind of wild gesticulations as some doctors. He doesn't, you know, raise his voice to the degree of like a John Pertwee or a Patrick Troughton. He doesn't walk into a room and like verbally commandeer the situation the way John Pertwee does. Like,
yeah.
John Pertwee doesn't give a shit, and he will just like talk over everyone and be a dick. And I love that about the Third Doctor. But Tom Baker, he's the kind of doctor where he's just kind of, sometimes he hangs back or he's just quiet within the middle of the room, and he just has this like alien energy where he will attract, the center of attention will come to him and you don't even know quite how it happens. And I actually, watching this one, I realized, oh, Peter Capaldi took so much from Tom Baker. And that's actually what clicked it for me, was comparing it to a modern doctor, because, you know, just as I would say Tom Baker is pretty different from the doctors who came before him, you know, we've talked about this before, Peter Capaldi is nothing like the other modern doctors. And it's actually something that I think when people have difficulty today with like the Peter Capaldi era, in that you can't just drop in and drop out the way, you know, you can. It is harder to warm to him like right off the bat in the way you can a Matt Smith or a David Tennant. I think Tom Baker works a lot the same way.
Yeah,
but when you
that.
Start to see what he's doing with it, and I actually think Brain of Morbius is a pretty like astoundingly good showcase for what he can do. Like, just thinking about any Doctor, which stories do you pick as a showcase for their talents? I haven't seen all the Fourth Doctor ones, but this strikes me as an uncannily good showcase, because even though there's a lot of scenes where he's not in this one, there's every scene that he is, like the first one, railing against the Time Lords and pulling out his yo-yo, and then later on, like when he's kind of drunk at the table or when he's with the Sisterhood of Karn, like pretty much every iconic, like, other than the Jelly Bellies, which aren't in this one, or Jelly Babies.
Yeah.
Every, like, iconic Tom Baker little mannerism, I feel like, that I've seen in other places, like in clip shows or whatever, or when he was in the 50th, he did the thing with his nose.
Yes, yeah. I was very pleased when he did that in this story.
Yeah. So just, I don't know, I actually got a really good sense for him, and I made a pithy tweet about this last night, which is that, you know, every Doctor brings something unique and special to the role. It's the thing we love about Doctor Who. Tom Baker is the only Doctor, though, who is actually an alien. He's from outer space. He's not human. He's just an alien. And it's obvious when you watch Doctor Who, because it is a, when you break it down, kind of a bonkers performance.
Uh-huh.
But with this, like, good, like, British mastery of acting. And that union is so wonderful and, as I said, just magnetic. You can't take your eyes off him.
Yeah. And it's something with Tom Baker that, like, it's... I still have no idea if he's actually, like, one of the most brilliant actors ever, or if he is just playing himself.
Yeah.
It's like, and I think it's kind of both at the same time. It's so hard to tell with him, because he's a fucking lunatic. Like, if you watch interviews with Tom Baker, the dude is fucking utterly insane. He just lost it. I don't know if he ever had it. The dude's just crazy, but in, like, the best way possible. And again, in that way of, like, you don't know if he's pretending to be crazy or if he's actually crazy. And that's the way that the Fourth Doctor is. That, like, you look at that guy, and you have no idea what's going on in his head. You think you know what's going on in his head, and there are times where you're, like, very convinced you know what he's doing, but you never actually do. Like, he does have this weird alien quality to me that, like, I have seen all of his stories. I've seen a lot of his stories multiple times. It's one of my favorite eras of the show. Like I said, I've seen this one multiple times even. And still there are moments where I'm looking at him and it's like, who is this guy?
He has this quality that I think certainly every modern Doctor has taken some from it, which is like, how can you add little unpredictable things to scenes?
Yeah.
And, like, you know, if I'm comparing this to, like, the immediate predecessor, John Pertwee, who we also agree is a fucking genius.
Oh, yes,
I mean,
yeah.
God, the first four Doctors, they hit home run. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking his immediate predecessor. John Pertwee is not an unpredictable Doctor in that way to me. Like, he very much has a stable presence and a stable kind of sense of that character that you kind of know how he's going to react to situations. Sort of almost like, and it's something that era of Doctor Who models itself on, like a James Bond or something.
Yeah.
And there's something wonderful about that character type. Tom Baker, it's not necessarily that the character does big unexpected things. It's just, he'll move through scenes in ways where he'll throw something in there that you're not expecting to see. Like, throughout the scenes with the Sisterhood of Karn, just the way he kind of verbally spars with them, and the way he both clearly takes all of this seriously and he doesn't want to be burned at the stake, but he also is aware that it's a really silly situation.
Yeah.
And that, I don't mean Tom Baker, I mean the Doctor is aware and is weirdly having fun with it. And just, like, little hand movements he'll do, like, definitely his, like, style of gesticulation is much more on the, like, Peter Capaldi kind of limited range than it is the, like, you know, Second Doctor, Seventh Doctor, 10, 11 kind of big movements or something. But I just, it's really hard to describe exactly what he's doing with it, but does this make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that does make this story a good one to sort of, like, kind of get used to Tom Baker's, I think it's got a very good first scene for him.
Of
landing the TARDIS and coming out and just being angry and petulant about the Time Lords interfering is something that's, it's a very Tom Baker thing. It's something they do multiple times through his era because, I mean, yes, it's something that also John Pertwee's Doctor has to deal with, but it's more abstract for a lot of his era, whereas, like, the Time Lords are just always fucking with the Fourth Doctor. Like, to the extent that there's a whole season of the show, the Key to Time season, that they are just, like, that's the whole season, is that the Time Lords have fucked with him and are forcing him to go on this quest that he in no way wants to deal with and have saddled him with a companion he does not want to have with him at all. And that's, like, the structure of that season. And there's something really fun about that kind of, like, very directly rebel Doctor, of that, like, he does not want to deal with this bullshit. He does not want to deal with this authority figure. He wants to just go and have fun and explore around and be goofy, and instead the Time Lords have plopped him here. So his reaction to that is to just be very petulant and childish and just sit down and practice his yo-yo tricks while Sarah Jane is actually out and, like, exploring around and doing the Doctor stuff.
I love how at this point they have taken the Doctor has infinite amounts of pockets to an extreme at this point, where it's a joke that comes up a little bit in the third Doctor era, where he has an unreal amount of stuff in his pockets sometimes. But here he has the yo-yo. In a later scene, Sarah Jane just knows to reach into his pocket and find
bolt cutters. Yes,
which is like, and I love Sarah Jane. I think her thought process was, I don't know which pocket it is. I don't know where I'll find them. But he has bolt cutters on him. I know this man.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is one of those things that, and especially like post Tom Baker, it's something that like modern Doctor Who likes to do here and there. It's a ridiculous thing in a pocket, but Tom Baker is, as the Doctor, sells that more than anybody because he's so nonchalant about it.
Yes.
He doesn't even notice it. It's just like, just pull this ridiculous thing out of my pocket. Like, here's this fucking magnifying glass or something. Here you go. Yeah,
but no, I mean, he is both a Doctor who is in many ways inscrutable in the ways we've been mentioning, and yet also once you get the vibe he's given you, it's like, yeah, of course this guy was the Doctor for 7 seasons. Like, because what story can't you tell with Tom Baker? Like, what places can't you go with him? And, you know, what audience would be unwilling to follow this guy? It's there's a reason he is, as you say, the most iconic in the broad history of Doctor Who Doctor.
Yeah. Yeah, some other things about this story, and particularly like that Time Lord stuff, and I think it just sets a good tone for the opening of the story and like the Doctor's relationship with this stuff. Is it like watching this and sort of like watching modern Doctor Who stuff, like all, like sort of side to side? It's always something that like I get kind of sad about some of the direction that modern Doctor Who went in that I think was necessary, but like had all the Time War stuff and the sort of like aggrandizing of the Doctor's character. Lost this element of like that Tom Baker can have in this story, that he's so kind of gets to be in the background and weird, and he gets to be the underdog rebel character, which is something that I think modern Doctor Who likes to hearken to and gesture to, that like this is who this guy was, but he can't be that anymore because of the history of the show and all these things. Which again, I think there's a lot of great storytelling things that direction opened up. But there is something about the heart of the show to me is still this idea of him being this rebel underdog that, you know, when you have Morbius there and you start to hear the history of Morbius, who is this villainous Time Lord who, you know, weighed lace to planets all across like the 7 galaxies or whatever, it makes you really like feel like, oh, the Doctor's probably fucked. Like, it feels like the Doctor does not compare to this dude, because the Doctor's just a normal Time Lord. He's just a bit eccentric. He's not a genius Time Lord. He's not an extraordinary Time Lord. He's just a weird Time Lord. In a way that, like, modern Doctor Who likes to make him out like he's basically a god among Time Lords. And this is like, nope, he's just got a fucking screw loose and that's it. Like, he's no better prepared to beat Morbius than anybody, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Which has been kind of a subtext of a lot of the recent Capaldi seasons, as Moffat has tried to move us back in that direction, although you've also seen where that genie can't always go back into the bottle.
Yeah.
You know? But no, yeah, and what better Doctor to underline that there's a screw loose than Tom Baker?
Exactly, yeah.
I love the Morbius thing. I also love thinking of, like, because I just got off of watching, you know, a bunch of Master episodes with Roger Delgado. Morbius is like if the Master had his heart in it had the skill to actually do evil things. Whereas the Master, I think, would never want to deal with the consequences of evil actions. I think Roger Delgado's Master is always counting that the Doctor will stop him. Because I don't know if he really wants to go through with it.
It would just create all this busy work.
I know. Yeah. Morbius is actually like, he wants to be the evil overlord.
Yes, that is. I like that read of Morbius's characters. That he's like he's the way that like people, the Master wants people to think that he's like Morbius.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. The other point about the fourth Doctor that I want to point out, particularly for this story, because I think this is just a very good version of it, is he's just got such a good fucking outfit.
Oh, it's so good.
In particular, like, this is because he has a number of different variations that he goes through over the years, and this one in particular might be one of my favorite Doctor Who costumes ever. Like, it's just the right... I've always really loved he has a very, like, earthy aesthetic to him. Like, all of his colors are sort of, like, reds and oranges and like, light or deep, like, dark browns. And that color scheme is so good for the Doctor and makes him feel like this very sort of, like, natural figure moving through the world around him. And he just blends in very well with everything. But it's got a really great sense of style.
It's such a great, like, especially going third Doctor to fourth Doctor, where the third Doctor really cared about the way he dressed himself. Yeah. He was a bit of, as I think John Pert would be the first to tell us, a dandy in how he dressed. And then the Fourth Doctor is like, fuck it, I will put it on my body if I think it's cool. This scarf is longer than I am. Like, it drags along behind me, but I'll wear it. It's awesome. It's a cool scarf.
Yeah. And Tom Baker has so much fun with the scarf throughout his whole run of Doctor Who. It's the best prop in the history of the show. And in particular, I love in this episode, there's a great shot, I think it's like maybe episode 3 or episode 4, where it's one of the several times he's gone back to Solon's castle, and he's sitting in the chair with his feet up on the table, and the two, like, sort of, like, ends of the scarf are laid along his legs and, like, rest over the top of his boots. Just sitting there with his, like, hands behind his back and his legs on the table. It's so fucking good. And you can just see Tom Baker, like, singing, like, what can I do with the scarf in this scene? Like, what weird touch? There's a couple of good little gestures and things he does in the scenes where he's going to be burned at the stake as well, where the scarf feels very present in those moments, that he just uses it so creatively.
It's nuts. It is an insane scarf, and he makes it such a part of the character.
Yeah, like, you just can't see him without it. Like, it's something that, whatever it is, it pieces everything together about the character.
There's a reason. If you asked anybody, what is the Doctor's, like, number one fashion accessory, it will be a scarf.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some kids today who would say bow tie, because that was very prominent for a few years recently.
Yeah.
But I would say, if you've seen more than one Doctor, you probably go with scarf.
It's that beautiful, beautiful scarf.
Oh, it's wonderful. Do you want to talk about Sarah Jane?
Yeah.
And her role in the story? Because not only Sarah Jane is wonderful in general, her role in this story, she gets to do some of the most badass shit a Doctor Who companion has ever done.
It's a very standout episode for our Sarah Jane Smith. Yeah, so Sarah Jane is, she's like, I think, like, the prototypical Doctor Who companion, like, fully sort of, like, gelled together now, that we've been sort of working towards in each of the eras, towards, like, what the, like, model for the companion that modern Doctor Who in particular really likes to go off of. And Sarah Jane Smith is very much that, like, but done to an exceptional quality, I think, largely because of the acting of Elizabeth Sladen. In that she is, you know, her character is actually sort of vaguely Lois Lane-esque. She has a... Her introduction is as an investigative journalist, which is something that they do bring up when they brought her back for... Russell T. Davis brought her back in his Year of Doctor Who in the Sarah Jane Adventure spinoff. That she's an investigative journalist who ends up stumbling upon the Doctor and ends up going back in time. That's the whole Time Warrior story, which is fantastic.
Companion introduction.
Oh, yes. It's so fucking just... because it's a great companion introduction, because she's at odds with the Doctor for, like, the first half of that whole story. And so it's the classic, like, before they team up, they have to fight each other kind of concept, but in Doctor Who. But then Sarah Jane Smith is that kind of, like young, contemporary British woman with, like, enough sort of, like, spark and fight to really stand out in kind of contrast with the Doctor. And there's something about her that I think she just has... I think, like, Elizabeth Sladen just throws herself into whatever story they gave her, and she really makes is oftentimes the companion in Doctor Who is a pretty sort of, like, nothing role. It's not like modern Doctor Who gives the companion so much sort of character stuff that sometimes they are the main focus of the show compared to the Doctor. And classic Doctor Who didn't really do that other than the first Doctor era, arguably. But so there are lots of companions in classic Doctor Who that are just kind of like, oh, right, you know, Mel, Perry, like who's Mel?
Oh, Perry is very memorable, wrong reasons.
Yeah, for the accent, sure, Perry Gilliam Brown, but yeah, like, Mel, which is a Sixth Doctor companion, is like my vision of, like, the most forgettable companion ever. Like, Tegan is kind of like that for the Fifth Doctor. There are lots of just, like, Adric, like who are these characters? They have, like, kind of one vague character trait that is only present occasionally in some stories when the writer, like, thought to add it in. And Sarah Jane Smith, there's something about her. She's just alive. She's active. She contrasts so well, both with John Pertwee, because she had a full season with John Pertwee, and then 2 seasons with Tom Baker. And she plays off of both of them fantastically. And I think it is that she has this real vitality to her, and that Elizabeth Sladen never played anything, like, soft or light. Like whatever it was given, like, she, like, really threw herself into the role. And this episode is a good standout for her, because they give her a lot of really fucking cool shit to do.
They do. And you know, We talked about if the Fourth Doctor is arguably the most iconic Doctor, Sarah Jane is inarguably the most iconic companion.
Absolutely,
I mean, to the point where, I mean, she's the only companion of a full spin-off show. The Sarah Jane Adventures ran for 4 years.
And they tried to give her a spin-off back in Classic Doctor Who. It just didn't get off. So, like, she's basically two spin-offs.
And Elizabeth Sladen was a beloved presence in England.
Oh, yes.
Like, when she died a few years ago, I mean, it was like a national day of mourning kind of thing. Like, she is a beloved figure over there, and rightly so. She just has... and I love comparing her... What I was going to say is, like, she has this youthful, like, energy spark in these episodes that... Where you just feel like there's nothing she wouldn't do if presented the opportunity.
Yeah.
But then you watch her later on in, like, the 10th Doctor stuff or the Sarah Jane Adventures, some of that, where she had this kind of warmer vibe to her where she just felt like, you know, the best, like, grandmother kind of companion, which is kind of literally the role they kind of cast her in there.
Yeah.
But she hadn't lost all those things that made her so wonderful earlier on. It's a great performance. And this one is a very, even though there's a lot of stuff going on in this story, it's a great showcase for her.
Yeah. She's also, I think, another thing that makes her work really well is that she's a little bit goofy also. Like,
yeah, she's a total
very
goof.
She's very funny. And, like, in particular, there's some other episodes that she has some really great stuff to play. But I think that is also something that pairs her really well with the Fourth Doctor, is that they are both, like, a little bit weird. Like, they're both a little bit goofy. In particular, you know, when the Doctor and Sarah Jane show up at Solon's castle in part one, and they're standing out there in the pouring rain, and the Doctor has his, like, comically small umbrella over his head, and, like, the pair of them standing there together fit so well.
I also love the moment here where she has just gone blind, and she's... as she's, like, trying to figure out what's going to happen to her in life, she just can't help but make a joke, and she, like, pulls her shawl around her, and she's like, I'm going to be a blind flower girl. And she, like, does the, like, Charlie Chaplin City Lights kind of thing.
Yeah.
Very funny. Yeah. And I love this. And that just feels in character for Sarah Jane, that she would make a joke in that moment, and the Doctor would kind of play with it, you know?
Yeah. You know, and if you thought that, you know, the Doctor was the badass and stuff this season of modern Doctor Who when he got to go blind, Sarah Jane did it first.
Sarah Jane did it first. And I love, in, I think it's episode 3, she is blind. She traps the villain in a room where she gets out and, like, locks the bad guy in the room. And then she just flees across the surface of an alien planet completely blind. And yes, she does get captured at the end and all that. But, like, just the simple act of going through all that, Sarah Jane is a badass.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, she's fucking amazing.
Absolutely. There's a reason she's the companion who had a spinoff.
Exactly, yeah.
Yes. But let's talk about supporting characters. Oh my god, they're so good.
Yes, yeah. So let's talk about Dr. Solon first, because he's obviously, he's the standout villain. He's just really fucking... Like, I had forgotten just how good he is. He's played by Philip Maddock, who has played a couple of characters in Doctor Who. Most notably, this is something I didn't know before... he plays... We haven't talked about it because we haven't watched it, but he plays the War Chief in The War Games, which is the last Second Doctor story, which is sort of like the Master before the Master, and he's really good in that as well. So, Philip Maddock, fucking... He's one of the great supporting actors in the history of Doctor Who, playing these sort of, like, one-off villain characters.
Oh, man, but Solon is one of my favorite one-off Doctor Who villains.
Yeah.
Just, he has... Like, that actor plays it like this is high Shakespeare.
Yes.
It is... Like, there is a lot of funny stuff, I think, around his character where the episode kind of knows when to wink and when to also be deadly serious, but he just plays it straight. And he is this doctor who is utterly committed to his cause. He clearly has a couple of screws loose. And he is, at some point in the episode, or in the story, like, genuinely terrifying because his commitment, like, knows no bounds. But he also has that kind of fun, universal, like, human villain thing at some points where, like, you know, he's, like, looking at Tom Baker's head and being like, this is so perfect, where you could slot him right next to Boris Karloff and he'd be totally in place. Or Christopher Lee or something. Like,
yeah.
Any of those greats.
In particular, like, he is particularly in part one when the Doctor and Sarah Jane arrive at the place and then he sees the Doctor's head and his physiognomy is, like, looking at it and stuff. It feels like Bela Lugosi in Dracula when at the beginning of Dracula, where it's like, he's just, you know, basically making puns about, like, I never drink wine, you know, and it's like, and for the person who's arrived, like, they have no idea what the fuck Dracula's talking about, but everyone who's watching it knows that Dracula's a vampire and is like, oh, you motherfucker, like, you weird motherfucker, and there's a bit of that quality to Dr. Solon in that scene that very much has that, like, universal villain role. And I like his character is, one thing I like about his character is that he's not just like Dr. Frankenstein, is that obviously a lot of this story is inspired by Frankenstein, but I think his character is a good mix of like some of like the more human qualities of Dr. Frankenstein, but also like the weird, like obsessive and kind of almost like monk-like, you know, removed from society qualities of Dr. Moreau from the Island of Dr. Moreau, and that kind of combination. He's like a nice sort of bouquet of all the different kind of mad scientist archetypes put together into one crazy motherfucker.
Because this was the biggest part of the episode, reading the history, that Robert Holmes really had to invent whole cloth.
Yeah.
Because this was where, like, whatever was in the Terrence Dix draft, that just they could not do. And, you know, Robert Holmes, I saw some of the interview quotes with him where he was a little disappointed, I think, in his work here just because he felt it was a little derivative. To me, this is proof that Robert Holmes wouldn't know how to phone it in if you asked him to.
Yeah.
Because, like, this was like a kind of a crunch job. You have to use kind of an archetypal Frankenstein thing. And it feels definitely like it is paying homage to all these different things you're naming. But it is also its own thing, and it works on its own terms utterly.
Yeah.
Again, Robert Holmes, if you asked him, like, phone in a script, he'd give you just a great Doctor Who story. And yeah. He couldn't do it. He would not be able to do it.
Yeah. Like, and one of the other qualities of Dr. Solon that I love is that he does, especially, I think, pairing him up with Morbius and having Morbius be this sort of, like, the real threat behind him makes his character really interesting because there are moments in the episode where it feels like he can kind of be reasoned with. And, in fact, like, you know, the Doctor and he sort of temporarily team up a little bit near the end of the story when they have to go hunt after Morbius' sort of, like, raged body, like, stomping across the surface of Karn. And that the fun dynamic of, like, you know, like, he's basically a villain, but there's enough human there, and he's clearly, like, a brilliant, like, surgeon, and he has all of his own ambitions and these own things he wants to accomplish by bringing Morbius back to life, that it makes him a multifaceted villain, which is something that you can't often say about classic Doctor Who.
No, and I love that quality about him, too. And there's a scene, maybe my favorite scene in these four episodes, just because of how scary and crazy and gnarly it gets, is the end of the third episode where he's got the brain case he's going to use and he's getting the brain ready, and who's the Igor figure? What's his name again?
Kondo.
Kondo, like, accidentally bumps into him and the brain falls on the ground, and just all this gross, terrifying stuff is happening, and in the middle of this, he's forcing Sarah Jane to, like, do the pump thing,
because
he has... Oh, also in the middle of that, he just shoots Kondo point blank.
Yeah.
And I was like, they could do that on the BBC in 1974? Yeah.
Like, they couldn't show this graphic violence on BBC now.
No, they wouldn't. Yeah. And it's just nuts. And then the brain falling out. Like, this goes to some, like, crazy places in terms of the visual horror it presents. And what ties that whole scene together is how far the actor pushes it as Solon while still being that character. Like, he doesn't break and have, like, a psychotic breakdown. It's just he's so stressed out and angry about all of this.
Yeah.
And he's, like, you know, fawning over this brain prop. And I love it. This episode just lets a couple screws loose even more at that point.
Yeah.
And it is genuinely kind of both hilarious and terrifying.
Yeah, he really does sell the tension as, like, the tension builds across the parts of, like, when the really delicate brain surgery starts to have to happen, you can feel how much is, like, anything that, any, like, small disturbance could completely ruin this thing that this guy has spent his entire fucking life trying to do, and you can feel that, like, when that goes wrong, he's just like, nope, like, you are going to pump this thing, or I'm going to fucking shoot you, like, I just shot my, like, the only other person I've known on this planet for, like, 20 years.
We talked about earlier this year when the Doctor Falls World Enough in Time aired, those two episodes, and spoiler, Bill gets shot in that, like, it's really rare to see a gun actually go off in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
What I love about Brain of Morbius, it's not like a laser gun. It's just a fucking pistol.
Yeah.
And he just shoots, like, just pumps that guy full of lead.
Yeah, and there's, like, in particular, because I had forgotten that there was this shot in this episode of, like, the first shot he shoots Kondo, it cuts to, like, a full front frame of Kondo. He's, like, he takes up basically the whole frame, and you see him just get shot in the stomach, and, like, there's a blood squib that shoots out of his stomach, and then it cuts back to Solon, who then shoots him a couple more times, and they don't have squibs for that. But just that one shot of Kondo getting shot and the squib going off, that's more violent than, like, almost anything I've seen in Doctor Who that I can think of. There's a couple of times in the Sixth Doctor era where they get a bit more sort of, like, risque with the violence.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's, like, oh, shit.
It's
that's in a way that feels like Not that it's like, oh, like, children shouldn't be able to see this, but just like, right, yeah, this is fucking real.
And of course, this episode had, like, you know, parents complaining.
Yeah.
And actually, that's a pretty good hallmark of Robert Holmes' episodes also, is that he would frequently, his episodes would get flagged. Like, even something as you would think innocuous as Spearhead from Space, like having the wax figure, like, presidents in that one was controversial at the time.
Yeah.
Just little subversive things he'd do. Or in this case, I guess that's not even Robert Holmes. That's the production team deciding that, because you could do him getting shot without the squib.
Yeah, plenty of people have gotten shot in Doctor Who all the time, you know? Like, that's like all the Daleks do, is they shoot people, they quote-unquote shoot people, and you just show, like, an overlay of their skeleton, and they collapse on the ground,
yeah.
And that's it.
No, but anyway, yeah. And then there's, so we talked about Dr. Solon.
Yeah.
And his trusty or not-so-trusty assistant, Kondo.
Yes, the Igor figure of the episode.
He's so great.
He's very good. Because he's, like, a good sort of, like, he's calling him the Igor figure does not fully do him credit, because he's kind of an interesting mix of Igor and, like, the Boris Karloff version Frankenstein monster, who's, like, big and giant and very strong, but is dumb and doesn't know how to use his strength and is easily manipulable.
And one of the things I love about this character and his relationship with Solon is that the typical way this sort of thing is done is that you have a tension between the two where you, like, we know Solon is ripping off Kondo and he's not really going to do what he says. And we're kind of waiting for that tension to break where Kondo will figure it out. It doesn't happen at the end of this story. Like, that tension rises and breaks and falls and changes throughout all four episodes.
Yeah.
Like, it's episode 2 when Kondo tries to kill Dr. Solon. And I love that, like, it doesn't play by kind of your expected playbook of how this pace is going to go. And I found that really refreshing.
Yeah, me too. I really love that scene where Kondo just finally decides. Because the whole thing, obviously, is that Solon is, you know, this genius surgeon and has, without Kondo realizing it, when Kondo crash landed on the planet, Solon took his arm and used it for his Morbius monster, which is I love the design of that Morbius monster, which that has, like, the one, like, you know, the dude in the costume just gets to have, like, the one actual, his arm just poking through.
And one that's a giant lobster claw?
Yeah, and the other one's a giant lobster claw, which is very good. But yeah, so, and I like that dynamic of Kondo, that Solon is using that in this promise of, like, oh, if you help me, I will put your arm back on and, like, take this weird hook I put on there off and put your arm and give you your arm back, Kondo. So it feels like Kondo, like, has this real material goal of why he's working with Solon. It's not just because he's dumb. Like, obviously he is being manipulated, but from his perspective, like, he is trying to get something very specific. And once he gets that arm, you get the sense of, like, he'd be out of here. Like once he gets what he wants, Kondo is gone. And I like that, as you said, it's not just, you know, that dynamic until the last episode where it breaks down and Kondo attacks Solon. Instead, it is episode 2 where he's like, you know what? No. Fucking, I'm fed up with this bullshit. You keep on telling me you're going to put my arm back on and you keep on not doing it. You are going to put my fucking arm back on. And he just sits him down, puts his fucking hook around his throat and says, you are going to go, like I will help prep the lab for you, but you are going to put my arm back on. And I like that it's one thing that is, it adds a good amount of character and detail to Kondo that also helps push Solon into a corner that helps make his character even more interesting.
Oh, absolutely, because there's just, again, there's so, not only are there multiple factions in this episode in that you have Solon and Kondo, Doctor and Sarah, Sisterhood of Karn, within those factions you've got infighting and stuff as you have with Kondo and the Doctor. So there are so many pressure points of tension that there's no slack in this story. There's no point where the script sags for a minute and we're stalling for time. Something is actively moving forward in one of these relationships and dynamics at every moment, and it is just, you know, profoundly good screenwriting.
Yeah, you always have something meaningful to cut back to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Should we talk about the Sisterhood of Karn?
Yes, let's move on to the Sisterhood of Karn, where you have a number of different sort of, like, background figures, and your main sort of the matronly figure who is named Merrin in the episode. And yeah, so for people who have seen some of, like, the most recent Doctor Who stuff, they have kind of come back in bits and pieces. And with the Night of the Doctor special with the Eighth Doctor, and then I like that. I think it's just like Stephen Moffat is so tickled with the way that actress plays the matron of the Sisterhood of Karn that he just brought her back a couple of times for Peter Capaldi, and I like that because that actress very much plays it like the way that the actors play the Sisterhood of Karn in this story.
But they had not come back again until Modern Who, right?
Yeah,
they
were, no, this was their only story before Night of the Doctor.
It's kind of amazing that no one in that intervening time did it. because it's a really rich well of stuff I think you could draw on. And this is still the only story that's actually like about the Sisterhood of Karn. But like they just have this whole weird little subculture that feels so fleshed out within the boundaries of these four episodes. They are kind of both creepy and silly. Like I love how they're always chanting sacred fire.
Sacred flame.
Yeah, it's very good. The woman who plays the matron is deliriously creepy in some moments.
Yeah.
And I like the other actresses who play it. Like, there's a very much kind of dance choreography thing going on with their different rituals. And it's like, you know, they're not really doing anything overtly evil in this episode. It's just like they've hit the boundaries of where their weird religion will take them. And now they're trying to figure it out. And again, they give Tom Baker such good stuff to play off of.
Yeah. In particular, I like a lot of like the sort of the production design work around them. And I think like all their costuming and stuff is great. And then but they have the most goofy but kind of amazing knives that they have. They're like, big, ridiculous knives that are like shaped like red flames. It's like fucking, it's incredibly goofy, but also feels very appropriate for this weird insular cultish religion that is probably like 15 people or something, but they're just 15 people that are immortal, you know? Yes. So it's like, it doesn't matter how many people are in the cult. The cult just gets to keep on going on because they're worshiping this fire.
I also like, and you've mentioned this before, that Robert Holmes tends to plant interesting little flags of Doctor Who mythology.
Yeah.
I like some of the fleshed out stuff here, that they have some hand in the immortality of the Time Lords as well.
Yeah.
It's not completely clear what all that is, but like they give some of the elixir to the Time Lords. In exchange, the Time Lords give them some amount of protection. All of that is interesting. And I also love that the Doctor does not care about any of that.
Yeah.
He is so far out of Time Lord politics. He's like, I don't care. And I also love that the Sisterhood of Karn has a real commitment to burning the Doctor at that stake.
Yes.
Because they try it once in episode 2, and they fail at the end because Sarah Jane rescues the Doctor and then goes blind temporarily.
Yeah.
And then the Doctor comes back voluntarily, and they put a net over him, which I love. Yes. They like a fishing net, like you'd go down and get it at the drugstore.
But I like that it's a red fishing net. So it's very much on brand.
Very much on brand. Like I like to imagine someone like brought director Christopher Barry like a white fishing net. He's like, no, give me a red one.
Yes,
this will be perfect. But no, and so they do that, and they get him back on there, and then he gets himself off it again and shows them the flame. But then they just knock him out anyway and bring him to Dr. Solon. Like, they really want the Doctor dead. And even by the end, when he's kind of like helped save them, I think they would try to kill him again. Which also kind of makes sense that the Doctor would go back to them later, because, you know, he's often friends with people who've tried to kill him.
Yeah. And there's just, the Sisterhood of Karn are such a delightful presence because they are both goofy and yet they also serve a really valuable dramatic role. In particular, like, there's a really great scene after the Doctor has kind of like made amends with them and is sort of teaming up with them against Solon, that they get to sort of like stop and talk a bit more about it, and like the Doctor gets to talk to them about like, no, eternal life is kind of bullshit, guys. Like, yes, you go on forever, but there's no change. You never evolve. You don't have any new ideas. You don't progress in any ways because you're like, you're stuck to this fire. And they serve, like I said earlier, a valuable thematic function in the episode as well. That I think helps bring clarity to some of the stuff that is going on with Solon and Morbius.
Yeah. And, you know, also, so fitting for the way Tom Baker plays this character, how the Fourth Doctor is written, that he's the Doctor who just wants to be out there exploring and being active. And the idea of, like, either one of these factions, either being Dr. Solon and so tied into, I'm going to stay on this planet forever and try to resurrect this dead thing, or being the Sisterhood where I'm going to be alive forever just in this one little cave, both of those are equally hellish an idea to the Doctor.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
And he plays that very well. Yeah. We want to talk about Dr. Morbius. It's not really a performance, but all the stuff that goes down with him in the last episode in particular.
Yes, yeah. So I think in talking about Morbius, we can talk about like some of like the plot stuff that we haven't covered so far.
And kind of start to wrap this up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Morbius, I love like all the sort of like the slow buildup of like the slow leak of information. This is one of the other things that the Sisters of Karn are good for, is building out that wider sense of sort of like vague mythology and world building of Doctor Who that kind of goes outside of the bounds of this episode alone, because you get the sense of, oh, like there are other, like, sort of, there have been other renegade Time Lords, but are not necessarily like the Doctor. And I've always loved the idea of Morbius as this sort of, like, great villain in the history of the Time Lords that weighed lace to galaxies and all this stuff, and was finally And then went to this planet to get the Elixir of Life and almost destroyed the entire planet and destroyed most of the Sisterhood of Karn and was finally defeated by the Time Lords and then had his body scattered through, like, the nine corners of the universe, I think they say. It's a great line. And then... But he has concocted some sort of plan where his brain has survived, and he's just this brain in a fucking jar. And so that slow buildup of you getting those little details about who Morbius was and the way that the Sisterhood of Karn... I mean, he's basically like Voldemort to the Sisterhood of Karn. They don't even want to hear his name. He's such a vile presence to them. And then that buildup too, then you, like, it revealing that, oh, he's this, like, kind of goofy-looking brain prop in this jar, but is really well written. Like, all of the dialogue for Morbius, I think, is really strong in conveying the sense of, like, he was this once great person who is now basically gone totally... He's completely insane. You know, even before he's put in the brain jar and all that shit, like, he's lost it because he has that great line, like, set of lines that he says to Dr. Solon about, like, do you have any idea what it's like not being able to touch, to feel, to see, to hear, to just be floating in this jar for eternity? Like, I don't give a shit what you put me in. I need to be able to feel something again.
Yeah. No, and... I love that there's kind of two segments to when he gets a body again, that there's the one where he is like a brainless monster, which is its own kind of fun, and then when he is fully sentient and the final confrontation with the Doctor is very interesting. But when he is a brainless monster, it leads to one of my favorite Doctor Who cliffhangers ever, which is the end of episode 3. All the bad shit has gone down. Dr. Solon leaves the room, and it's just Sarah Jane, and then the monster starts to wake up. And as he's waking up, Sarah Jane is regaining her sight, and he comes up to her. Phenomenal cliffhanger. That's just... And I almost actually wish they'd cut, like, 10 seconds later on the cliffhanger when Sarah Jane says, "I can see," and he puts the hand on her.
Yeah.
I almost feel that might have been an even better place to make the cut. But either way, it's just a great way to end one episode and start the next one, because it's, again, there's so many different points of conflict going on. When you put them into conflux like that, it's great.
Yeah. And just, like, the suit, though, like, it's a weird fucking suit, but there's something that, I think particularly the claw is a good detail, and the way they use the claw to just, like, pincer people and, like, kind of strangulate them and strangle them to death, it's again, you can very much tell that it is, like, very lightweight and made of cardboard, because of course it is, but it does, there's something, like, good about it to me. I don't know. There's something good about, like, the pincers. Yes, it just works.
I mean, this is one of those cases where, like, they probably could have made a quote-unquote better costume if they wanted to, but it looking that just gnarly and pieced together, I think very much suits the character.
Yes. And in particular, just having the one, like, normal human hand from the dude who's in the suit poking through is very good. There's something about that sells the monster to me really well.
I also love the brain case thing, like the plastic case, is a great design. The best thing about it, though, is that you have that whole conversation where Solon is, like, Morbius is urging Solon, just use the brain case. And Solon is like, "All right, I'll do it." And he goes over to the trash can and pulls it out.
Yeah.
And he's just chucked it in the bin. I love that.
Yeah. It's like, it's a good thing that Morbius doesn't have a nose, because that glass bulb probably does not smell very good.
No. But then when he is sentient and intelligent, this leads to a brain wrestling match with the Doctor, which works better than it has any right to.
It's a really good finale. It's something that you get to have. It feels like a very Doctor Who final confrontation, that it would be weird if the Doctor had to fight Morbius.
Uh-huh.
It's just like, you know, fisticuffs. That's much more a John Pertwee thing. He would have sword fought him. But yeah, Tom Baker, it's you put your head in a weird little thing and you have a mind wrestling match, basically.
Which I love that that's just set up in the room for them.
Yeah, you know, they just had all the equipment there, is what Morbius says. It's very good. I also just like that Morbius is a brain in a jar, and it kind of feels like that equipment probably shouldn't work if you're just a brain in a jar. Like, it looks like you're supposed to put an actual head in there, but, you know, he gets it to function somehow.
Yes.
Yeah.
We also here get one of the earlier instances of seeing pictures of other doctors.
I think it's the only instance they've done it that's outside of a crossover, isn't it? Of, like, the three doctors.
There is one, and I forget which episode it is now, but I remember I perked up at it in the John Pertwee years, where we see, there's only two other doctors at this point, but they do have the picture of William Hartnell, and then Patrick Troughton, and then John Pertwee comes in. There's some video screen, it might be a Master Story, where that happens, but yeah, this is at least one of the earlier times.
Yeah, where you it's something that modern Doctor Who likes to do more because they have more pictures to pull from. But yeah, you do get a nice like look at John Pertwee and Patrick Troughton and William Hartnell. And then you get a look at a bunch of fresh-faced young British men that are all the they're different members of the production. So like Robert Holmes is in there, Philip Hinchcliffe is on the, in there, and is one of the more infamous pieces of like Doctor Who continuity is that the original intention for the episode was that all those faces were to have been previous incarnations of the Doctor that are pre-William Hartnell. And then eventually, Doctor Who was like, no, William Hartnell was the first, that's his first incarnation, you know, and then, you know, in Deadly Assassin, they set up the 12 regeneration limit and that kind of stuff that then makes that obviously, like, a more important thing to tackle, like, how many incarnations of the Doctor have there been. So people have all their weird theories about it. I think generally it's just, like, looked at it as like, ah, those are just, like, different versions of Morbius that we're seeing, and that's his past incarnations. Because you do get a good look at, I don't know, I have no idea who the actor is, but of like whoever, like the model for that bust of Morbius, and he glares, and there's a good music sting there before it shifts to the Doctor's incarnations.
Luckily, nothing in the scene is so overt that like it can't work today in the modern continuity.
Yeah, you can reinterpret that very easily. Yeah.
It's not like, you know, Sarah Jane comes up and shouts, oh my god, look how many Doctors there have been!
Yeah.
Which is lucky. Yeah, because it would be really weird if William Hartnell was not the first Doctor.
Yes,
that would mess with so much
Doctor. There's so much Doctor Who continuity built on the assumption that William Hartnell is the original incarnation of the Doctor.
But it is also fun to kind of go back and be like, right, you know, they're only 13, only, but you know what I mean, relative to 53 years now, they're only 13 years in. You could play with that if you wanted to, I guess. Like, it's not so set in stone, because we're only on the fourth Doctor, but like now that's such a ridiculous idea as we look at the 13th Doctor.
Yeah. And it's also something of, like, this is, I think the fourth Doctor is basically the first time they have, when the third Doctor regenerates into the fourth Doctor, that's when, like, the term regeneration sort of gets solidified. Like, before, like, they played around with, like, renewal was a word they used a lot, and now it's like, no, like, we're talking about these are, like, regenerations, he regenerates. That, like, language has only now come into parlance in Doctor Who. So it's fun, yeah, to look at, like, when they could be more playful with the continuity, the history of the show, and it wasn't quite as set in stone with some of those rules that we have now.
Yeah. So we should probably start wrapping this up. What other thoughts do we have on the brain of Morbius?
One other thing, a detail I had totally forgotten about that is kind of amazing and really weird, is that the Doctor straight up fucking murders Dr. Solon. He kills him with cyanide.
That is true.
He poisons him with fucking cyanide.
I needed to ask you about that. I remember I was going to note that, and I'm glad you brought it up, because I was like, is that our read on that Solon just fucking dies? And it's like, yeah, there's actually no other way to read it. He just kills him with cyanide, and Sarah Jane is really eager to help him with it.
Yeah.
Let's be clear on that, too.
And it's a really good scene of them being trapped in the room and having to figure out, like, what do we do? And it's I think Tom Baker does a really good job at playing the Doctor knowing things that, like, you know, the audience has no way of knowing that he knows of, like, oh, like, this is something like, oh, these bunkers are always made in the same kind of model, and, like, all the, he just rattles off all this stuff. Like, Tom Baker's very good at making that dialogue feel really natural. And then they just, you take all the chemicals that are in that room, and he makes fucking cyanide and puts a thing in the vent, and makes cyanide in the vent, and then it goes up, and it poisons Solon, and he's dead.
Yeah. Yeah, here's the thing, you know, in general, I don't think the Doctor should kill people. He's also not Superman. Sometimes the guy do what he got to do.
Yeah.
And I totally buy that the fourth Doctor, Tom Baker, if you push him hard enough, he will kill you without a second thought. I would be kind of scared to meet that man in a dark alley.
Yeah. And also, like, you know, it's kind of on Dr. Solon for not fucking noticing that the room was filling with, like, cyanide gas, dude. Like, yeah, you were so obsessed with the idea of putting this thing together, you didn't even see that cyanide gas was filling
the room
for the vent. That was very visible.
If they had thrown in a line where the Doctor's like, I thought he would leave by now, I think I would buy that.
Yeah.
That, you know, like, the Doctor wasn't just intending for him to stay there and die and asphyxiate. But yeah, he kills that dude.
Yeah, it's a weird little thing at the end of the episode that feels like it's just like, well, we need to wrap this up in some way. And I think it would have been hard to sort of like try to script in a reason that like Morbius would have killed Solon or something like that, which is the more sort of like generic version of how that would have played out in a different episode of Doctor Who.
But yeah.
It worked for me.
Don't leave Tom Baker alone with a bunch of chemicals.
Yeah, no, it's dangerous. Yeah, that's like either as the Doctor or just Tom Baker in real life. It's just, nope, you don't want that.
All right, so Sean, next month, We're not jumping ahead to the Fifth Doctor just yet, because as you were telling us last month, the Fourth Doctor era is long enough.
Yes, it's very long, and there are lots of different eras of the to look at, and I think to kind of split it into.
So you think to do the best like due diligence on the Fourth Doctor, we need to do one more, and what will that be?
Yes, so next month we are going to look at the latter era Fourth Doctor story, The City of Death, which is of course pinned by the immortal, the incredible Douglas Adams
himself. I'm so happy.
It is one of the... I think you could very easily make the argument that City of Death is the best Doctor Who story.
Wow.
And I would be... I could put that argument together. So I'm very excited to talk about that one and continue on with our adventures with Tom Baker and his wife, Lala Ward. Next episode.